loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. A verdict is expected today in the International Criminal Tribunal of former Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic. 21 years after his indictment and 7 years after the start of his trial, we'll take a look at the role of this tribunal that was set up by the United Nations. A team from RT Documentary Channel was able to find its way into the Syrian town of al-Shaddadeh just days after its liberation from ISIL, the so-called Islamic State. They obtained unique footage and documents portraying life under the rule of ISIL. We'll speak to one of the journalists who was there about what these astonishing documents show. Yesterday was the deadline set by the Colombian government and the FARC, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, to sign a peace deal. But with issues lingering, a deal has still not been reached. Is Colombia plunging deeper into civil war? But first, we turn to the International Criminal Tribunal on the former Yugoslavia. We are joined from Toronto by Chris Black. He is an international human rights attorney who served as a legal aide to Slobodan Milosevic in The Hague. We are also joined by Richard Becker, a lead participant in the International Tribunal for U.S. NATO War Crimes in Yugoslavia. Chris Black, let's start with you. Why did you oppose, as I know you have, because I've read your writings and I've heard you speak, you say the International Special Tribunal isn't really a court. Talk about the nature of this court.
Like all the ad hoc tribunals from Rwanda to Sierra Leone to the Hariri one and the mixed ones, they were set up for political reasons and only have political reasons to exist and not proper courts. And the United Nations set them up under Chapter 7 of the UN Charter, which deals with international peace and security. So that's a political article. And it does not give the United Nations Security Council any jurisdiction to set up such a body, but they've done it anyway. So they exist de facto, but the jury in law, in my mind, and as Milosevic and many other prisoners have pleaded before them, they have no right to try anybody because they don't really exist. And it's quite clear that the ICTY in particular was financed by NATO countries, mainly Britain, Germany, Canada, United States, and private corporations like General Electric, Westinghouse, George Soros Fund, and so on, Open Society Institute, all which have an agenda of destroying Yugoslavia and breaking it up into pieces.
Private companies and private entities actually fund the special tribunal?
Right. All of them, because they have a UN budget, but they also created for all these tribunals a special fund into which corporate sponsors could donate funds to help pay for these.
So the trial of Radovan Karadzic or Milosevic is brought to you by XYZ private entity.
Right. And one of the big ones, I mean, as Westinghouse, you can look at many defense corporations, Boeing's in there. And investment fund dealers like George Soros, who have lots of interests involved in penetrating Eastern Europe, raking up the socialist countries that used to exist there.
Richard Becker, talk about who Karadzic is and who the other defendants are in these war crimes tribunals, or Slobodan Milosevic, the former leader of Yugoslavia who was found guilty at these special tribunals, which, as Chris Black says, are not real courts. Give us the backstory.
Well, Yugoslavia was one of the most diverse countries in the world, and it emerged from a very heroic period after World War II, where it had liberated very large parts of the country from Nazi occupation at an enormous cost. About 12% of the population of Yugoslavia was killed in World War II. And the main fighting was done by the partisans, who were led by Tito. There was another group, an armed group that was following the monarchy, and it was a very reactionary group known colloquially in history as the Chetniks. And Radovan Karadzic came from that background. And had that orientation, and has had that orientation clearly, of really that narrow nationalist point of view. What Yugoslavia tried to do what the leadership in Yugoslavia tried to do was to bring together a multinational state of 24 different nationalities. There were six republics and two autonomous regions. And it was a tremendous project to do this, and it accomplished a great deal. But there were internal forces that were egged on by the outside, by Germany, by the United States, France, Britain, Italy, to try to pull Yugoslavia apart, particularly in the aftermath of the fall of the Soviet Union. They had been fine with Yugoslavia because Yugoslavia had its own differences with the Soviet Union in the period leading up to the early 1990s. But once the Soviet Union fell, the vultures gathered and struck and supported all of the narrow forces, whether they were Serbian or Bosnian or Croatian, Montenegrin, Macedonian, to pull Yugoslavia apart in order to subjugate it. And in that period, what happened was that from the project, this great multinational project, there was the rise of a narrow nationalist civil war that led to great destruction and atrocities on all sides. But it has to be said that those who have been singled out, for the most part, for being hauled before this so-called court, and I agree it's not really a court at all, are those who, mainly those who opposed the U.S. And NATO project for transforming Yugoslavia into a number of small, digestible sized countries that they could then incorporate into NATO itself.
Chris Black, the war in Bosnia and in Yugoslavia, it had different stages and phases. It started in 1992. Then there was the siege of Sarajevo in 1995. In 1999, from March, mid-March, or the end of March, till June 3rd, 1999, NATO went to war against Yugoslavia. And that was over Kosovo. The NATO forces, including the United States, dropped about 28,000 bombs and missiles on Serbia and parts of Kosovo that where Serbian military forces were. Were any of the NATO military leaders or political leaders who carried out that war, were any of them brought before the special tribunal?
No. I was part of a group headed by Professor Michael Mandel here in Toronto, who, and some other lawyers, who filed war crimes charges with Louise Arbour, who was then prosecutor of the ICTY, to indict NATO leaders for their attack on Yugoslavia. But she refused to do that, as she refused to prosecute people at the Rwanda tribunal. And she then, of course, and she was responsible during the war for stopping a French-German initiative to stop the bombing at one point by issuing an indictment against President Milosevic for war crimes after consulting with Madeleine Albright and President Clinton, which effectively made him a war criminal, so he couldn't be negotiated with. It stopped that effect, that initiative, and the bombing went on and only ended when Milosevic was faced with an ultimatum from the Americans passed through Mr. Artari and Yeltsin's foreign minister, Mr. Chernomyrdin, in June, that unless they surrendered, the Americans were going to carpet bomb Belgrade with B-52s and kill 500,000 people. At that point, they decided to give up. That's the only reason they gave up.
And by giving up, meaning they signed an agreement to allow Kosovo to become essentially independent from Serbia.
Well, it's a part NATO victory in a way, because at Rambouillet, France, 2 weeks before the bombing began, the real reason for the war was that Albright gave a diktat to Milosevic contained about 30 or 40 items. The two most important were that Milosevic, the government of Yugoslavia, what was left of it, was to allow the immediate occupation of the whole country by NATO forces, and the country was to convert from a socialist to private enterprise society overnight. They refused those two items, and then that was the reason they began the attacks.
I mean, that's quite amazing. I was just looking at the Rambouillet agreement, the declaration that Milosevic walked away from, which started the bombing campaign. One part of it, it says Chapter 4A, Article 1, the economy of Kosovo shall function in accordance with free market principles.
Right.
Now, Kosovo is rich in mineral resources like gold, silver, mercury, and other things. I mean, how does whether an economy is free market, meaning privately owned to the dictates of capitalism, or publicly owned, dictated by socialist economic planning. How does that have anything to do with human rights?
Because it wipes out every social, economic, and political right the working class has. What they've done is take a socialist, a fairly prosperous socialist society, and convert it into a capitalist society with all the results, where people are impoverished. Free education has disappeared. Free healthcare has disappeared. So the right to health, the right to work, the right to form unions, the right to vote for all sorts of parties, not just capitalist ones, including socialist ones, the right to real freedom, democratic rights, local councils, that all disappeared.
Richard Brecker, you know, Chris Black answered my question in one way, which is giving up these public property has a diminution of some social and economic rights. But I was also asking, from the point of view of the war makers, how could they cite the absence of a free market as the rationale for an international humanitarian military intervention whereby they would drop 25,000 bombs and missiles on a country? I mean, and let me just go back to the Rambaye agreement, that Milosevic refused to sign. It says the NATO commander is the final authority in theater regarding interpretation of this document, and his determinations are binding on all parties and persons. That means Milosevic had basically a gun to his head and told, look, let NATO take over Kosovo, or we will go and have all-out war against your country. Talk about that.
The Rambouillet Agreement was signed in February of 1999, or presented in February 1999, just a month before the bombing started. And it was an ultimatum. It was a declaration of war disguised as a peace agreement, and there's no question about that. I mean, the many provisions, and I wrote about it at the time, the many provisions included that NATO had to be granted the right to the use of airports, roads, rails, every facility that they wanted, not in Kosovo, but in all of Yugoslavia, and that the Yugoslav government had to pay for it. There are so many provisions like this, it's just amazing. And then
Donald Trump would like that. Build a wall and you pay for it.
That's right. That's right. Exactly. And, you know, then right after the bombing stopped, there were articles that came out about a top secret briefing that that Madeleine Albright, who orchestrated this and who is herself clearly a war criminal by any standard, had met with the press on top secret basis. But two reporters later reported the exact words that they had taken down in their notes. And they said that she had said to the assembled group, "We intentionally set the bar too high for the Serbs to comply. They need some bombing, and that's what they're going to get." In other words, that's a confession that this is a crime against peace by the United States government, that this was a war of choice, another war of choice, like Iraq, Afghanistan, so many. And it was a war that was carried out against a country that did not and could not threaten the United States. That classifies as a crime against peace. And Clinton, Bill Clinton, and Madeleine Albright and the others who carried out that war should be in prison and should be facing a tribunal if there was any justice. But the tribunal is not based on justice. It's illustrative of the power relationships in the world and nothing more.
Yes, and that's who's going to be sentencing, you know, Karadzic this today, perhaps, or perhaps tomorrow, Chris Black. Both he and Ratko Mladic were turned over, and he was a military leader in Bosnia. He was turned over by the new Serbian government to the special tribunal, and that turnover also appeared to be completely political. I mean, can you talk a little bit about that?
Right. There was a lot of, I was in Belgrade at that time, and there was a lot of hostility, unrest among the population that the NATO-installed government, the DOS regime government, those have followed them, acquiesced in the transfer of both Karadzic and Mladic because they're considered to be heroes there. Allegations against them are entirely contrived. What they did was respond to a civil war by NATO countries and tried to protect the Serbs in the areas that broke away. Their indictments against them are political. The trials are political. They're not fair. All sorts of reasons we could go into if we had time. And the entire structure of this tribunal is political, and they can acquit or convict whoever they please. And they also acquit for political reasons. For instance, it doesn't matter what the evidence is. Whatever decision is made is a political one. And they can convict or acquit if they want. And General Perisic, who was the Yugoslav Army Chief of Staff, was charged with genocide. And if anybody had command control of the forces involved, and if those forces did commit those crimes they alleged, which they denied, and I believe it, but if Perisic was in command, he should have been convicted. But he was acquitted, and he was acquitted because he was arrested by the Yugoslav military police because it turned out he was receiving money directly from the CIA during the war. So he was a traitor working for the CIA. So he was arrested. But in the logic, they had to charge him because he was the chief of staff. So they had to charge him, but so he went through a pro forma trial, and he was acquitted. Karadzic, there's no evidence against him, but he could equally be convicted because of political reasons. And it's all, the whole thing is a show trial, and it's meant to put out propaganda about this is what happened in the war, not that. It's to fool the public about what really happened and to justify the attack by NATO on Yugoslavia to destroy that country. And that's all it's for.
Richard Becker, Karadzic was turned over by the new Serbian government the day Carla Del Ponte, who was the chief war crimes prosecutor, came to Serbia. I can't remember whether it was 2008 or 2009, but she said in order for Serbia to have an ascension into the EU, in other words, to become part of the EU, they would have to do certain things like turn over these people who had been in hiding, who obviously had the public support of a big part of the Serbian population. That too was political, wasn't it?
Well, I don't think that there's any question about that. I mean, that would have been the coincidence of all coincidences, and of course it wasn't a coincidence at all. And what has been imposed on Yugoslavia has really pushed a country. I've known many Yugoslavs over the last 25 years and who just are in a state of shock as to what happened to their country, how a country that had developed so far and that had so much in the way of benefits for its people had been reduced to what it's been reduced to. And it could not have been reduced to what it's been reduced to without the intervention of the big powers that intervened and for their own reasons wanted to tear Yugoslavia apart, to take control of the different pieces that were left from the former Yugoslavia. And, you know, what is a court, an international court, to focus on one country? Maybe that's to excuse some country that's carried out the greatest war crimes in history, and that is the United States.
Very, very selective prosecution. We are out of time. We've been talking to Christopher Black. He's an attorney in Toronto, an international human rights lawyer, and by Richard Becker, a lead participant in the International Tribunal for U.S. NATO War Crimes in Yugoslavia. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
We are back. I'm Brian Becker. A team from RT Documentary Channel was able to find its way to the Syrian town of al-Shaddadi just days after its liberation from ISIL, the so-called Islamic State. They obtained unique footage and documents portraying life under the rule of ISIL. Not only did they learn firsthand from the people about their conditions of life, but they discovered ISIL documents about its economic activities, its sale of oil, and about how ISIL does business. We'll speak to one of the journalists who was there about just what these astonishing documents show. For security reasons, we cannot reveal the identity of this journalist. When did you arrive in al-Shaddadi?
We came to al-Shaddadi 10 days after it was liberated by the YPG and their allies.
And just talk about that. How was the area liberated? How long did the fighting go on? Was the fighting still going on when you were there?
Well, the area was liberated pretty much fully by the time that we got there. Obviously, there were some still pockets of ISIS members and their supporters remaining in Shaddadi and the area. For example, when we were there within 1 week, there was 3 attempts to attack the Kurdish forces there. So there was a suicide car. There was a suicide car bomb. That tried to hit one of the Kurdish block posts, but it was shot and exploded before reaching anybody and hurting anybody. Also, there was a case of 2 men wearing suicide belts, but they were disarmed before blowing themselves up. And so it was a little bit of a tense situation still. The Kurds and their allies kept pushing south very fast, and that's why there was a lot of like, let's say, quote-unquote, cleaning up to do. So when we got there, it was still a bit tense. Actually, our group came under fire when we were trying to film at the front lines with the YPG. Thankfully, nobody got hurt, and basically, we just, overall, we were there for around 2.5 weeks.
So while you were there, you had an opportunity to meet with and talk with and get the views and observations of local people. I believe you also had an opportunity to interview ISIS or ISIL prisoners who had been taken prisoner by the YPG. What did you see? What did the people say? What was the feeling there in the area? And how long had it been under ISIS control or the control of other armed groups? In other words, not under the control of either the YPG or the Syrian Arab Army.
Well, Shadadi is actually a very interesting place because it is a very oil-rich area. However, that's sort of the curse of the area as well, because everybody, about 75 to 90% of the people, that's according to the locals, work in oil or oil-related services. So basically, the Syrian Arab Army has been, let's say, kicked out of there by the Free Syrian Army 5 years ago. The Free Syrian Army itself has been kicked out by Jabhat al-Nusra around 1.5 years later. And then later on, they have been kicked out by ISIS. So the people of Shadadi and the areas have sort of gotten used to living under worsening conditions for the past 5 years, with the prices rising and the schools kept being closed down and the conditions kept becoming more and more strict as new groups took over. So the general opinion of the people was that they were scared. They were actually very reluctant to speak with us on camera. We had to convince them that basically ISIS is not coming back and we are doing personal stories while also trying to figure out what's going on in the region. And we have been lucky enough to speak with the locals that have been involved in the refining process. They were employed by ISIS for pennies to refine the crude oil that they extracted from the ground. So basically, at the same time, we also got a chance to speak with three captured ISIS prisoners. One was a local from Shadadi, the other one was a Saudi, and the third one was from Turkey.
So it's an oil area, it's an oil region. Now, there's a lot of talk in the Western press, at least recently, it's not really covered well at all by the corporate-owned media in the United States, that ISIS or ISIL, Daesh, the so-called Islamic State, has been able to profit from the oil trade. When you were there, what did you find out about that?
Well, in terms of the oil trade, there has been some speculation, of course, and there has been a few reports done by that, but it was very difficult to actually prove anything. You would have to be either inside ISIS or come, like we did, to a freshly liberated territory and hope to be able to find some evidence. Now, what we were lucky enough to come there early, well, early in a sense, 10 days after it was liberated. And when ISIS fighters fled, they left everything behind. They left clothes and their wives' bras and medications and documents and even weapons, which were later picked up by the Kurds and their allies. And we basically went into houses that were formerly occupied by ISIS officers and translated the documents that we found on the floor with the Kurdish YPG. So what we found actually was documents which basically kept track of every single oil well in a certain field around Shadadi. Now, obviously, this was not everything that ISIS was producing. This was just basically a grain of sand. And we don't know how big the actual trade was, but we found 170 documents with receipts documenting how many barrels ISIL pumped from a certain well on a certain day, how much they were sold for, and the total amount. And it amounted between $25,000 to about $35,000, $40,000 per day, just on one single field.
Could you tell from the documents who was purchasing the oil?
Basically, the chain went like this. ISIS pumped the oil from the ground. They sold it to refineries. Those refineries later on, which paid ISIS a tax, of course, those refineries later on produced very cheaply cleaned oil, which was later on sold elsewhere. because the chain was so big, there was no final destination of where the oil went in the documents that we found.
So if you have ISIS making, you're saying from one oil well in one place, $25,000 to $30,000 per day.
In one oil field, yes.
One oil field. And was this a highly productive oil field, or was it a medium or a low productive?
This was a medium to low oil production field. So there were fields, and there are still fields, that are under control by ISIS, which produce much more oil than this field around Shadadi did. So the total amount of how much they sell, you can only guess. If we sort of think about that this is a low to medium production oil field, and we calculated and we translated the documents that we found, you can gather that it could be around $1 billion more, give or take, dollars, US dollars per year that they make off oil. Now, obviously, this is just more like an educated guess, which is supported partially by documents, but in general, this is basically what we could calculate.
There's been a lot of talk and speculation. Again, it's mostly speculation. I don't know about the level of documentation and proof, but certainly speculation that ISIL was able to take oil that was being produced either in Iraq or in Syria and transport it through Turkey, and that it had the de facto support of agreement with the Erdogan government, allowing the financing of ISIL, even at the same time that NATO, a member, the eastern flank of NATO, a U.S. military-led military alliance, was identified as struggling against ISIS, that this was actually a gateway for ISIS to sell oil and thus sustain itself. Was there any proof in the documents about that connection with Turkey or other connections with Turkey?
Well, in terms of the oil documents specifically, they basically documented how much oil ISIS produced and sold to individual traders. In terms of the documentation from Turkey, there were documents that pointed to a general support of Turkey, a general support of ISIS by Turkey. For example, we found a brochure, which was also just left lying on the floor, which had the title of How to Fight the Ideal War Against the Criminal Assad Regime, which was printed in Istanbul, in Turkey, with an address, with a phone number, with a name, and a Facebook page, for example. There were many medicines from Turkey coming in, and one of the most interesting things is that we got to speak to an ISIS member, former ISIS member, who is now captured by the YPG, from Turkey. And when we were trying to get sort of his personal story, he mentioned that it was very easy for him to cross the border into Syria, and he went with 10 other people. And there was no soldiers, there was nothing else. And the same story was repeated by a Saudi national who has never been to Turkey, and he just managed to cross the border into a country where war has been going on for the last 5 years without a problem. Another interesting thing that was said by the individual, the ISIS member from Turkey, was that he volunteered the information, actually. We were talking more about sort of how he crossed the border and we asked, why do you think it was so easy? And he said, well, because I think that Turkey is using ISIS to fight the war against the Kurds. At the same time, they also have the economic interests in oil. So the testimony from the former ISIS member was that Erdogan is buying oil from Turkey, ISIS itself. And basically, he's getting an economical benefit and a political benefit as well from having ISIS at the border.
Why, if he told you, did the Turkish former ISIS person who's now in prison or in custody, I would take it, by the YPG now that they've liberated the town, why did he join ISIS?
You know, it was very interesting because I wouldn't really say that these former ISIS members or maybe even the current ISIS members exactly have a plan or have some sort of great intelligence, because his answer, and we tried to get it from different sides, including you knew you were joining a terrorist organization, so why did you do it? His answer was that he was bored. And he was tired of seeing the same faces every time, and so he just decided to join. The answer of the Saudi individual who joined ISIS was like, I heard there was a war in Syria, and my friend said, well, you can help out. I mean, you could go join the Al-Shabaab, or maybe you can even join ISIS. And the guy said, so why ISIS? And his friend replied, well, you're a Muslim, and they're Muslims, so why don't you go? And the guy said, good idea, all right. basically, sort of, that was the story. Individual that we met from Shadadi, for example, the local who joined ISIS, he said that basically there was no other money, and there was no money, there was no jobs, so he just decided to do it for the sake of money.
Not exactly zealots, in other words. People who were bored or unemployed or sort of adrift or looking for adventure.
Well, in a sense, that's part of ISIS's clientele, their future recruits. It's people who basically want to potentially find themselves in a new role because their current role is not good enough for them in some way.
For most of us outside of Syria, we can only imagine what life is like under the rule of ISIS. You were actually in a town that had been under military control by ISIS for some time, and you got a chance to talk to the people. How was it for them under ISIS? How did their lives change, if in fact they did change?
Well, you know, everyone said that it became much more strict. Now, the interesting thing is the YPG have started fighting ISIS in predominantly Kurdish areas. Shadadi and its area is predominantly inhabited by Sunni Arabs. So ideologically, well, let's say they were called to be the group that's mostly close to ISIS because that's where they try to sort of get the most recruits because they claim to be the sort of the clean form of Sunni Islam. So these people, the people who live there, basically they were very scared because in a sense they just wanted to live and work and did not really care too much for ideology. But because ISIS came, it was they mentioned that it was very strict. So people were beaten and executed even for such things as smoking, depending if whether it was your first offense or your second. And life has become worse for them than Nusra, and Nusra's presence made it worse for them than the Free Syrian Army. And the Free Syrian Army, basically, they mostly, you know, interesting thing is people were not talking big politics, you know, they were talking mostly about prices, like things that affect them day to day. So they mentioned how prices started to rise, how it was difficult to, for example, go find schools for their children. And these are the conditions that people actually cared for, you know what I mean?
Does the YPG have a sense of confidence? Is ISIS gone and sort of gone for good? Is this now retaining some sort of level of military stability and thus a certain level of security stability for the population?
Well, there's definitely a security stability because people are free to travel without sort of explaining why they have to go anywhere. There's still a curfew, well, at least when we left. At this point in time, perhaps it has become a bit easier. But there was still a curfew where no civilian cars should travel after sundown because, as I said, there were still pockets of support for ISIS in these communities. You see, the YPG has liberated these areas very fast. So, for example, when we were there for around 2.5 weeks, they have liberated another 30 kilometers to the south. Obviously, while they're having this blitzkrieg down south, they were not able to check every single person that stayed in these areas since. So in terms of safety for the population, I think it's going to take some time because these poor people, they have been going from militia to militia to militia. They don't know what to expect from the YPG. They don't know what to expect from anyone who would come there because for the last 5 years, they really haven't seen anything good.
We have about 90 seconds left. Let me ask you, you have like an amazing amount of information here. You've talked to people who lived under ISIS. You have documents that show how ISIS sort of procured oil, sold oil. You've talked to people who are ISIS prisoners. What will the RT documentary team do with this information?
Well, we are now working on putting together a documentary film, which we're hoping to have air on RTD in 4 languages, either in late April or early May. So stay tuned for that, and we'll have all the information that we mentioned there.
And final question, last 30 seconds. When you came out, were you happy? Did you feel in jeopardy while you were there? How did you feel?
To tell you the truth, I felt sorry for the people who had to go through all this stuff. Because we live in our safe places, and we listen to the news about Syria, and we go, oh, that's sad. But these people actually have to go through with it. And the people who go through with it and the kids who are growing up there, I mean, I know everybody talks about the children, but really, like, these kids, they don't really have much of a future because ISIS and the previous groups closed their schools, sort of left with them without a future. I really wish for them to sort of find some sort of a solution.
Thank you for your coverage, your courageous coverage, your informative coverage, and, of course, for your empathetic coverage. We will look forward to seeing the RT documentary about this town. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
We are back. I'm Brian Becker. Yesterday was the deadline set by the Colombian government and the FARC to sign a peace deal, but with issues lingering, the deal has still not been reached. John Kerry, Secretary of State, held unprecedented meetings with both the FARC, that is the Revolutionary Guerrilla Group, and the Colombian government in Havana this week. Could peace still be on the horizon? We are joined by James Jordan. He is the national co-coordinator at the Alliance for Global Justice. Welcome back, James Jordan.
Glad to be here.
Yesterday was the deadline set by Colombia and by the FARC, that's the Revolutionary Guerrilla Group, to sign a peace deal. The day came and went, though, without an agreement. Is that significant?
I don't think in and of itself that the day came and went is of significance. I had been hearing, you know, from people that have connections to different to the negotiations that they would all like to have reached that deadline, but there were a lot of details to be worked out. So nobody was really completely sure or even believing that that deadline was going to be reached. And that was just, you know, because of details. However, what is significant and what's very, very worrisome has been a real rise in attacks and assaults against members of the Colombian left and human rights defenders, and that is indeed putting the whole process in jeopardy. It's very much a concern. For instance, the FARC, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC, would be, I think one would consider it foolish to lay down their arms if there are no guarantees of security.
Okay, so let's talk about this sort of conundrum that the FARC is in. They have had an armed struggle for a long time. Other groups, and including the FARC, at different times have entered into ceasefire agreements. They've entered into the political process, and then having no weapons, they have also been in large part gunned down or terribly repressed. So obviously, if there's a new wave of repression going on at the moment that the treaty is about to take effect, that's of grave concern. But let me say or ask you about this. The FARC leader, Rodrigo Londano, called the meeting in Havana with Secretary of State John Kerry, quote, historic, unprecedented, unimaginable, close quote. Now, you've been in Havana. You've observed some of the negotiations or at least some of the interim agreements. Tell us and tell the audience what brought the situation to this point where the FARC leader could call a meeting with John Kerry historic, unprecedented, unimaginable.
Well, it's also, you know, has to be mentioned that this is coming right after the meeting, you know, of Santos, President Santos of Colombia in Washington, D.C., with the White House there. So I think for the Obama administration for many political and business interests in the United States, that there is a desire for stability in Colombia. And I think that they are also being encouraged to support the peace process by the Colombian government itself. So it is historic. It is unprecedented. For the FARC, I think that there's a recognition and that, you know, unfortunately, other people are recognizing this too, that a peace in Colombia will not work unless the United States is on board with it and stops supporting war and repression, at least as overtly as they have up to this point. There's a lot of concern with the new Peace Colombia plan that Obama has proposed that actually is leading to an increase in military aid over last year, an increase in military financing by 54% over last year. So there's going to be continued military aid. But I think, practically speaking, that there has to be some buy-in by the United States government on this peace process. So that's why I think this is taking place.
Well, I'm wondering if there's a two-track policy, and the two tracks are kind of contradictory, both by the United States and by the Santos government. That's the Colombian president, who is not a liberal or a progressive in any way, which is
right.
Sign a ceasefire with the FARC, sign a peace agreement, have them lay down their arms, talk about peace, talk about a great future, and at the same time using extra legal forces or death squads to carry out systematic or still persistent, at least, repression and murder against activists. I saw recently the number of 25 activists who have been murdered recently as this process is unfolding. How big of a problem is it?
Well, it's a huge problem. And it is actually, I mean, what Aida Avea of the Union Patriotica, or Patriotic Union, their leftist political party, he said there had been 29 people killed between February 11th and March, or February 27th and March 11th. And this is a very worrisome increase. It happens at the same time that ex-president Uribe, the leader of the extreme right wing in Colombia, is calling for demonstrations against the peace process on April 2nd. There's been a rise in attacks against human rights defenders, a rise in attacks against environmentalists. Displacement continues to go up, and so we really have to question what is the nature of the peace that the government and that the oligarchies of both the U.S. and Colombia, what is the nature of the peace they want? I think what they want is an end to the armed conflict, but they don't want to lose ground on the giveaway of Colombia's resources to transnational corporations and big landowners. And I think that they've shown repeatedly through the past that they're willing to pursue all kinds of measures of repression to get what they want. So the guarantees that the guerrillas are securing in the peace process for safety and for the ability to participate in the political process are very, very important. And aside from what the Colombian people can do to make this peace a peace with justice, to make it a lasting peace, it's just very important for us internationally to be watchful and to be aware of what's going on. And for us in the U.S., we really have to take our own country to task for its continued support for war and repression. But it's all very serious.
So we have different political players here. We have the president, Juan Manuel Santos, who is shepherding the process or facilitating the process, along with the FARC, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, who have been in an armed struggle since the early 1960s, I believe. Then you have President Uribe, far right, the leader of the far right. And of course, the far right includes many, many death squads who, you know, function with impunity, killing thousands of people, trade unionists, journalists, peasants, you know, poor people who were trying to mobilize. Uribe said he felt offended that the U.S. government met with what he called, meaning the FARC, the world's largest drug cartel and terrorist group. He said he was offended that the U.S. met with them. So what I think you're saying is that there's a war perhaps within the oligarchy or within the Colombian establishment over the sagacity, the wisdom of this peace process. Should it be shut down? Should it be sabotaged? And Uribe and those forces are working to do just that. And of course, they must have their supporters inside the United States. If President Obama is for a peace agreement and if he's sending his Secretary of State to meet with the FARC in Cuba, obviously John McCain, the Republicans, and others will try to sabotage that. So it sounds actually fairly precarious.
Peace in Colombia is always precarious, unfortunately. They've come close before to working out peace agreements. My understanding, my reading of the history is that this is the closest that they come this time. And there are some different factors going on here. There is huge support in Colombia for a peace agreement. And this does cut across class lines. It is exactly what you're speaking about, splits in the oligarchy. And there's new levels of awareness and monitoring going on. So it's precarious, but it's still hopeful. But yes, everything's in a balance, and it's this continuing struggle, and it's a struggle we need to be a part of. I will say that one good thing that has come about, and, you know, everything remains to be seen, promises are made and promises are broken, but the government has, in response to the increase in violence, has called for the establishment of a commission that will look at each of the reports of political violence. And this commission includes several representatives from different government offices, but it also includes representatives from the political movements and from, you know, from the left and from human rights.
Let me ask you, though, I want to come back to the sort of the balance of forces or the relationship of forces and what's at play and what the right wing, what former President Uribe and the right wing death squads and assassins are worried about, that section that is aligned with one wing of the Colombian oligarchy. If the FARC gives up its weapons and enters the political process and has a legitimacy to function within the political process, is it that they fear that Colombia could go, say, in the direction of what happened in Venezuela or Bolivia or Ecuador, or El Salvador or Nicaragua, where in the case of El Salvador and Nicaragua, you had the FMLN and the Sandinistas, left-wing former guerrillas once entering the political process became in the ruling party now. Is that what they're worried about, that the FARC could actually have that kind of political weight, or FARC and its allies, within a peaceful process?
Well, I think they are worried about that, of course. and this is what the Colombian left is banking on largely. They believe that they have support throughout the country and that they can put together a coalition that can make a big impact on Colombian politics and that can eventually win, take power in Colombia, you know, as long as they have anywhere close to a level playing field and security. So I think that they do worry about that. I also think with Uribe, and I mean, you reading that quotation about where he's saying that the FARC is the biggest narco traffickers, well, he was listed on the Defense Intelligence Agency analysis in the early 1990s as one of Colombia's top 100 narco traffickers. And nobody holds it credible. Nobody who is credible believes this line about the FARC being major narco traffickers. Everybody knows that any money they make is off taxing narco traffickers who come into the area anyway, you know, to buy crops from peasants who can't otherwise get crops to market to make a living. But they don't approve of the drug trade and they're not a part of it. So he's lying there. So I think they fear the power that a politically united left could achieve. But I also think that they fear losing control, because if there is security, that means that the government will have to come down on the paramilitaries and the narco traffickers. And Uribe is the chief of the paramilitaries and the narco traffickers.
Yeah, it's a very critical moment for the people of Colombia, obviously, and of course for the people of the region. Talk about, if you would, where the Obama administration hopes to land in the next few months, because it is running out of time. If the Obama administration is facilitative of this process, and obviously they are, because Kerry would not have met with the FARC in Cuba, talk about what the Obama administration seeks to do quickly if it, in fact, considers Colombia to be a priority.
Well, I think they do consider Colombia to be a priority because it's a very important wedge state geopolitically. It's very, very important to U.S. Efforts in Latin America, U.S. interests in Latin America. But I also think that your analysis that you talked about earlier regarding the peace process is true of the U.S. government, too. They want peace. They don't necessarily want peace with justice. And they want peace, but they don't want any kind of challenge to the interests of the 1% and the very wealthy and the oligarchy. And I think with this, that's why now we have to contact government, we have to take to the streets, we have to protest and oppose the Peace Colombia plan that the Obama administration has proposed. That would bring another $84.5 million in military assistance to Colombia. It means $38.6 million up from $25 million for what they call military financing, $46 million more for what they call counter narcotics assistance and military training. We hear about this from the Obama administration at the same time that the Colombian government continues to arrest and incarcerate unionists and members of the political oppositions in jails that have been funded and refunded by the United States and restructured on the U.S. model. So they want peace, but what kind of peace do they want? They don't want to give up or lose anything for the very rich and for the big corporations.
Well, we've been joined by James Jordan, and he's from the Alliance for Global Justice. We know that the U.S. government just met with the FARC, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, a historic meeting, according to the FARC representatives themselves. But you have President Obama preparing to send huge amounts of new military aid to the government. We don't know where Colombia is going. Of course, the Colombian people want peace, and the progressive forces want to enter the political process where they think they will do very, very well. We are out of time right now. We want to thank James Jordan. That's all the time we have. We want to thank James Jordan and our other guests. We will be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.